Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Utahns take to the streets outside of BYU to protest the Border Patrol's presence at campus job fair. No snow, no problem. Inside Utah's high-stakes plan for the 2034 Olympics. And a Salt Lake City Council member cannot imagine even ceding an inch on traffic calming in the face of a new bill. We're joined today by Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Dylan Eubank. Dylan, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV is with us. Jose, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Good morning.
Thank you. And we hope to be joined soon here by Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Let's start with Dylan Eubank. You were, I guess, at the protest. This, since it was BYU, I guess this couldn't be on campus. They were off campus.
Yeah, so they were directly across the street from BYU's campus. They were on a sidewalk at the intersection of 900 North and Campus Lane.
And remind us, what were they protesting?
So BYU held a career fair yesterday, and CBP, or U.S. Customs and Border Protection, were at the career fair. They were actively recruiting students, and students were concerned, and other faculty members, and so they felt the need to protest outside of campus.
So Border Patrol, they've had a table at this event for a few years?
It looks to be that way. There have been, sometimes they show up, sometimes they don't. It all depends on BYU. They are the ones who actively invite employers to come to the fair, yes.
Yeah. Now, on the one hand, you could say, well, Border Patrol, they're usually at the border, but lately, not so much.
Exactly, yes.
Similar protests happened, I think, at UVU.
Yes, the day before, there was another protest. Before BYU, CBP was at UVU's campus and doing the same thing with a similar booth. For a similar career fair, essentially. And so I think people were more surprised about BYU because they are a private institution. And so just the dynamic at both schools was, I guess, tense, but nothing, I guess, violent occurred at either locations. And so that is a positive in these scenarios, but still students and faculty and many international students felt unsafe on campus the past couple days.
Yeah, so you talked to several of the protesters. What were they saying?
Many of the students that I did speak with, they were concerned because many of them, they knew friends who were immigrants. BYU is a very reputable school for having a global presence. There's a lot of international students. Many of the students speak multiple languages. And so I know many of the students who were international students didn't really want to come to campus that day just for fear of retribution. They may not know what's going on politically in our country. And so they just felt the need to, I guess, maintain their safety.
Yeah, several took issue with the school and also with the church, right? The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Yes. So BYU is owned and operated by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And some students and members of the church who were at the protest felt that this was sending an indirect message to members of the church and students and other affiliates of BYU, as allowing them on campus kind of seems as a violation of their own institutional standards of being politically neutral. So that's kind of what their concerns were yesterday.
So look at some of the photographs of signs. BYU do better. Jesus would be disappointed. One held up a sign saying the pioneers were illegal immigrants. Mm-hmm. No ICE in Provo. Of course, we're talking about CPB, but ICE is a related agency. Were there any voices, at least around the protest, in favor of Border Patrol being there?
Yes, there were a couple of students, not quite as many as against CBP's presence, but there were a couple of students that I did see that felt that their presence on campus was justified as they were recruiting and, from what we could tell, not actively looking to detain anyone. And so I did watch a video of one of the students who said that he felt that their presence on campus was justified just simply because they're trying to provide opportunities for students for a career-wise, as it was a career fair, right? Mm-hmm. But I guess those conflicts between those students and those perspectives were very heavily present at the rally.
Any word from BYU officially?
BYU has not responded currently to our questioning. But we expect a statement from them over the weekend.
So there were some folks who were at the fair, right? Inside, right? With t-shirts.
Yes.
Tell me about them.
So I spoke to a couple at the protests, and he was telling us that they were wearing shirts kind of in protest, but they weren't, I guess, shouting at the career fair. One of his shirts says that, I think this is correct. It says, immigrants make America great. And his wife had a shirt that says something similar. I'm not remembering off the top of my head what hers were. I think it's I stand with immigrants, I think is what hers said. She was a member of the faculty, BYU faculty, and he was a BYU alum. And they walked into the career fair. They kind of chatted with some students, and they were standing, I would say, near the CBP's booth and table. But they weren't engaging with the recruiters there. But security detailed had come up to them and asked them to leave the fair. And then he and his wife kind of explained that she was faculty. And so an administrator from the university came to them, asked them to leave, or else, you know, they'd be trespassing and would be arrested. And so they did leave, and they were compliant, but they just felt a little disappointed in the school for proclaiming to be politically neutral, but with their presence on the campus, some people felt otherwise.
Mm-hmm. I guess this one of the gentlemen you're referencing here says, "I'm disappointed that BYU considers our church politically neutral." He wants the church to not be politically neutral, at least on this issue.
Yes. So he I was talking to him, and he went to the school a while ago, and he now that his wife is, you know, a faculty member, he feels that they're unable to share their own political opinions on this campus. And having CBP's presence, which is lots of the immigration politics going on right now in our country, they felt that they wanted to join in and speak up. But at this university, apparently, according to him, some opinions can't be shared in certain spaces. And so that was his major concern at the rally today, or yesterday, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Has the church issued any statements on, I guess, these protests, or what's been going on in Minneapolis?
Mm-hmm. As far as I know, the church has not released a statement about these particular set of protests, but I know in years past they have made statements about immigration and about unity in our country and among communities. And so we are kind of waiting to see if President Dallin H. Oaks will lean in that direction and see what he kind of talks about in his public address next Tuesday at BYU.
That's right. Yeah, he is coming to BYU. Yeah. Anything else you'd like to say about this story, Dylan?
I mean, I think it's self-explanatory. I think there are people protesting, there are people against the protests, right? And so we'll just have to wait and see how this continues to unfold across other parts of the country.
One thing I learned from the story about UVU, the Border Patrol was at their job fair the day before, right? So Courtney Tanner, and you contributed to the story, I learned that there's a civil disobedience club at UVU, and yes. they were there protesting.
Yes, they were.
Yeah. Well, Dylan Eubank, Religion Reporter, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Before we go to break, I want to talk about a somewhat related story. Jose Davila IV, you did a story on Border Patrol. I'll just read the headlines. Border Patrol detentions at a Utah auto shop spark questions about warrantless arrests. I noticed in the photos of that BYU protest, there is one sign that says warrants. They wanted warrants for arrests. So, Jose, tell me what happened at this auto shop.
So a video online went pretty viral on Friday of last week, about a week ago now, of Border Patrol agents working in West Valley City, making an arrest of a man at an auto body shop called Viper Auto Care. And the woman who took the video, she was the wife of one of two men arrested in that operation. And what happened was is that agents went into this auto shop, broke the front door to enter, but they did not have a judicial warrant nor an administrative warrant to do so. So it was a bit of an odd case and obviously sparked some questions about when and how federal law enforcement agencies, especially federal immigration law enforcement agencies, use warrantless arrests.
So you talked to a few people about this. Tell us a little bit about this. There's judicial warrants, right? There's administrative warrants. And when are each required, I guess?
Yeah, so a judicial warrant is sort of what you normally think of when it comes to a warrant, right? Law enforcement officials, they go to a judge and they say, hey, judge, we believe that we need to search this place that is normally private, a home, an office, whatever the case may be. We need to search this place as a part of a criminal investigation or an investigation into, and it could be a civil investigation as well, I believe. Those warrants are kind of stronger, right? They allow law enforcement officials to do that search kind of no matter what a person, you know, in that office space, in that private space might say. An administrative warrant is a little bit different. And in this case, and when it comes to federal immigration law enforcement, an administrative warrant is narrower in scope, mostly because it is simply signed by higher ups at the particular law enforcement agency. And so specifically when it comes to ICE, we see ICE officers often use administrative warrants as a way to enter into spaces that they normally wouldn't be allowed into. And they'll, you know, they'll tell people that they're targeting that they have a warrant. But those warrants, these administrative warrants, do not have the same power and do not compel somebody to open up a private space to those law enforcement officials. So in this case, these Border Patrol agents did not have either of those two warrants. Those are some of the key differences in warrants in this space.
In the meantime, these two gentlemen have been, we think, removed from Utah or probably in other states at this point.
Yeah, that was the reporting we picked up on Monday and Tuesday as we were reporting out this story. It's possible things could have changed for one or both of them. But yes, the shop's owner, who can be seen in the video, his name is Ismael Avalos. His family believed he was in Wyoming over the weekend, last weekend. And then Wilmer Menjivar, who's the shop's other employee who was arrested, his wife, Lily Gonzalez, believed that Menjivar was in Arizona.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that it kind of illustrates in specific the broad scope of some of these families. Mr. Menjivar, his wife, I think, is a citizen.
Mm-hmm, correct.
And the children, yep, would have been born in the U.S. In the meantime, he's probably going to be deported back to El Salvador.
Correct. Yeah. Both of these men have three and Menjivar has three kids who are U.S. citizens, and Avalos has four. Menjivar in particular seems like is set to be deported. He has a prior order of removal, basically in his immigration case. The process for the federal government to deport him is a little bit easier than it is in Avalos's case. And his wife, told us that, they didn't really have the money or plan to fight, his immigration case. So she was resigned to moving her and the rest of her family to El Salvador to be with Menjivar there.
Mm. I guess both gentlemen have lawyers. What are they trying?
Correct. They actually have the same lawyer. Specifically in the case of Avalos, the men's lawyer, Adam Craik, plans to file a wrongful detention lawsuit against the federal government because of the way that Border Patrol agents pursued one, Menjivar into the shop, but then arrested Avalos and Menjivar once in the shop. So he believes that that Avalos has a case in federal court, not in immigration court, in federal court to be released, and then to kind of restart his case, his immigration case, as well as he was actually in the process of getting a green card. So they would like to restart that.
So ICE has been saying that, and you know, Homeland Security, they've been saying that they're targeting violent criminals, targeting illegal immigrants with criminal records. I think you looked into at least one of these gentlemen.
We looked into both, and neither had any criminal history that we could find specifically in Utah. Neither had any juvenile court cases against them or including them. And so Avalos did have some traffic citations, you know, a speeding ticket, a seatbelt ticket, that sort of thing. So we did check, and yeah, this doesn't appear, they don't appear to have criminal records. The Department of Homeland Security, however, did say that Menjivar had been deported before and then crossed back into the United States after that deportation. That is a criminal charge. That is a criminal act under U.S. law. However, I was not able to find that federal case if one existed against Menjivar on that count. But in their statement to us, DHS did say that Menjivar, they called Menjivar a quote criminal illegal alien, but that was kind of what their argument rested upon.
Mm-hmm. One more thing, Jose, on this, there's some people say it would are questioning that the Border Patrol is usually at the border, right? And ICE is in charge of finding illegal aliens in the U.S. But that's been kind of blurred and illustrated by the fact that it was Border Patrol in this case, right?
Correct. Yeah, this is a change. A lawyer we talked to who was unaffiliated with either of the cases said that they had heard that Border Patrol had arrived, that CBP, which is the parent agency of Border Patrol, had arrived in Utah and was helping. They weren't sure to what extent. This is a trend we've seen across the federal government and across the country this year, or last year, really, since President Donald Trump returned to office. In Minneapolis, a lot of the operations, immigration-related operations there, have been carried out by Border Patrol. So it's a new trend. Traditionally, Border Patrol operates about 100 miles from borders, as well as at ports of entry. So it is a change, and we'll see what happens if we see more Border Patrol arrests here in Utah.
We've been talking with Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll have you back a little later in the program to talk about a dispute between Salt Lake City and the legislature. But we're head toward a break now. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following a break, here's the headline: no snow, no problem inside Utah's high stakes plan for the 2034 Olympics. We'll be talking with outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, and we bring in Salt Lake Tribune outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Here's the headline: no snow, no problem inside Utah's high-stakes plan for the 2034 Olympics. Of course, this week, the beginning of the Milan-Cortina Olympics, and February-ish of 2034. We'll have them here in Utah. So your story kind of tackles the question, what if we're at that point having a winter like we're having right now, right?
Exactly. Yes. As everyone, you know, skiers, non-skiers, it gets a miserable winter as far as snow goes. So, yeah. And if you go anywhere near any of these, you know, any of these venue sites that they're going to have in 2034, even the high altitude ones, it's brown. So, yeah, I was curious as to whether they'd be able to make it happen if we had something like this.
So you went to Soldier Hollow Nordic Center. They'll be hosting some of the events in 2034 near Midway, right? A lot of brown, you said.
Yeah, it's very interesting because it's just basically this one white ribbon of manufactured snow, and everything else is completely brown around it. Yeah, and Soldier Hollow is interesting because it is it will be Utah's lowest elevation like mountain venue. And obviously the Oval and things that are inside are lower, but it can't go much higher. It can't, the organizers can't move it to a much higher location because at 6,000 feet, it is basically at the threshold of where the Nordic organizing body, Nordic organizing body says that, you know, if you go any higher than this, there's not enough oxygen. If you go any lower, there might not be enough snow. So they're kind of right in the middle.
There's a sweet spot there, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you talked to Fraser Bullock, the president of Utah 2034. He doesn't seem worried at all. And you go into your story why he doesn't seem worried. So let's start.
Right. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's start with snowmaking. I learned a lot about snowmaking from your story, Julie. It sounds like they think if the temperature's at a certain point, they can make all the snow they need.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, that's kind of been their plan all along. And even if we had an amazing year like we did when we had the record year, they would still make snow because that's something that the athletes prefer because it's a little more predictable, right, than natural snow. So the plan, whether we had snow or not, was to make snow. The only issue is whether the temperatures will be cold enough, which has been kind of the problem this year. You need about 28 degrees when you factor in like the temperature and like the humidity. And if it's not 28, it's really not efficient at all to make it. And you're kind of just blowing, I don't know, sleet into the air. Mm-hmm. So they needed that. And that's been one of the issues this year, right? Is that even the resorts will tell you that for a long time there, especially during the holidays, they didn't have cold enough temperatures, even at night, to make snow.
I guess that's a key, right? As long as it gets down to 28 or below sometime during the night, you could make the snow then.
Right, exactly. And that's kind of the idea behind this new technology with snowmaking. It's basically just smarter, right? It's more efficient, but it's also more efficient just in that they can use smaller windows to make that snow. So previously, people would have to physically go out and turn on the snow guns and whatnot. Now they can do it from a tablet, from their phone, and they can take advantage of windows that are as small as half an hour of 28 degrees or below. And then if the weather goes warmer, they'll turn those off again.
You know, in the story, snowmaking process has been criticized for intensive water and energy use. Is that alleviated somewhat with the new technology?
The energy use with the newer technologies can be cut by as much as half, which is great. The water efficiency, it's not really that much more water efficient, except that the snowmaking itself is more efficient. So it's still using basically the same amount of water. They're just picking and choosing their times when they turn it on a little more.
Now, you note that for the Olympics, the last few times, increasing need for manufactured snow.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's been kind of a wild trip, right? Sochi, everyone was like, well, how are they even going to have it in Sochi? Because that's a resort town in a resort area in Russia. And they had temperatures up into the 60s, but they did much of these techniques. They made snow, they banked snow and kind of put it under these tarps to keep it over the winter. They trucked in snow. So that was in 2014, but there they made 80%, and then Pyeongchang was 90%, and then it's pretty much agreed that that all of Beijing's snow was mostly man-made.
I was searching for this in your story, Julie. The term wet bulb temperature, that's what we're referring to, that 28 degrees, or combination of humidity and heat. I'm going to try to
Right.
remember wet bulb temperature. I can impress my friends
There you go.
with my
Your
knowledge.
trivia question of the
Yeah,
day.
that's
Yeah.
right.
Yeah.
They even have a plan if we can't manufacture the what they call technical snow. They could go up to, I guess they did this before, they could go up to Strawberry reservoir area and get some snow and truck it down.
Yeah, that was what they planned to do in 2002. They made snow and they collected snow up at Strawberry Reservoir, which is about 7,300 foot elevation, I think. And then they just had dump trucks on call ready to bring it down if they hadn't gotten the snowstorm that they did right before the 2002 game started. So they were ready to do that. They're ready to do that again. I don't know, by then if 7,300 feet will be high enough that we'll have snow there. But they say, as Fraser Bullock told me, that there are other higher mountains in Utah, so they will find places to make the snow and or bring, I guess they call it farming the snow and bringing it in.
Wow. They're even talking about storing snow. Could you make some snow and then store it through the summer, or make it earlier and store it?
Exactly. Isn't that kind of mind-blowing that, because especially with the temperatures that we get in the summer, but these are higher elevations, so a little bit cooler. But yeah, what they do, and that's what Nordic, or not Nordic Valley Study, that is what Soldier Hollow is planning on doing, or they're experimenting with this summer, is they are making a lot of snow right now while the temperatures are cold enough, and then they will put it under an insulated tarp in a shaded area. And then they will just try to keep it until next year. And they said if they can do that, then they plan to be open by November of next season, which normally would be kind of out of the question for them.
And Fraser Bullock says, even if we can't do all of that, we could maybe use the calendar. What's he talking about there?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So the big issue really, with hosting the Olympics and is that you're also hosting the Paralympics, which is amazing and just this amazing competition, but they are always held and have traditionally been held after the Olympics. And for the last decade, a little bit more, I think they have been required to be held together in the same site. And the problem with that is that in March it's starting to get warmer even still. And so that is where the temperatures are just they're going to be, scientists say, probably too warm to keep the games or to keep snow going or to make snow. So they've talked about they looked at moving the Paralympics before the actual Olympics, which would have them in January, which would be obviously great snow, but they said that the logistics of trying to build the Olympics and all the security gates and things that they have, it just would not work to build the Paralympics first. So they said they'll have to do it afterward. So they may either move up the date of the Olympics, or they may just shorten it's about a 2 or 3 week gap between the two games. So they may just shorten that. But they don't expect to have to do that until 2050 or beyond, or whenever if they host again past 2034. But who knows if we're warming this closely. They may need to do it sooner than that.
Now, some athletes are saying that if they do move it up in the calendar, that might be problematic for qualifying for some.
Right. Yeah. I mean, again, we're looking at a situation like we had this year, right, where there's not snow and temperatures are generally warm. And so many of the qualifying events, even for these Italy games, the Milan Cortina games, were canceled because of lack of snow. And so some of the athletes are saying, well, hey, if you move the games up even earlier, like that takes out a couple more weeks of our training or our trying to qualify. And you can't really move it back because, October, you're probably not going to have warm or cold enough temperatures in most places. So yeah, it's going to make that a little bit trickier.
Now, you mentioned 2050, 2080. Researchers are looking at this, right? It looks like there might be dwindling sites that could even host Winter Olympics if you go out that far.
Yeah, if you want some really, if you're just, you know, too happy and you need something really depressing, you can look at this study that I looked at that basically says that if you take the two games together, the Olympics and the Paralympics, that even this year, 2030, I guess the Alps, the next Olympics in 2030 in the Alps, there would only be two sites of 93 sites that they studied that could actually host the games without artificial snow, which, yeah, is pretty depressing. And the numbers just keep going down. Even if you add in snowmaking to the equation, they found that only 17 of those 93 sites would be able to host the games by 2050, even with snowmaking, mm-hmm. and only four by 2080. So, yeah.
I want to just mention a couple of other stories, Julie Jagg. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints pledged significant financial donation to support the 2034 Olympics. So there's some more money coming in.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. The organizers have already raised about, I guess they announced $250 million through donations from kind of foundations and more major donors, which is sizable considering that I think last time they hosted in 2002, they had a total of $88 million in 2034 dollars. So way ahead of that goal. And then, yeah, the church announced earlier this week that they would be adding a significant donation, financial donation, but did not say how much.
Yeah, another story on progress reports from various sites, including Los Angeles 2028, Brisbane 2032. Salt Lake City stood out in the fact that they're pretty much prepared right now.
Right. Yeah. It was really, really an interesting, I just kind of tuned in early, honestly, to that one, to the other presentations, just out of curiosity. And it was interesting to me how much they were taken to task. They're IOC members, International Olympic Committee members, who are appointed to kind of keep these hosts on track for making their deadline to be able to present a game when they're supposed to. And in the French Alps 2030 especially, and then also the Brisbane 2032 Summer Games, they were really kind of taken to task for not having key things buttoned down. And the French Alps one, they said that this was a critical year. If they couldn't do it this year, things were really going to be in trouble.
Well, Julie Jagg, outdoors reporter, thank you so much for telling us about this.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to head toward another break, and we'll be talking after the break with Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. Here's the headline. A Salt Lake City council member cannot imagine even ceding an inch on traffic calming in the face of a new bill being proposed at the Utah legislature. We'll talk about that on Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring back Salt Lake Tribune Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. Thanks for coming back here, this part of the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Happy to talk.
So let's turn to Salt Lake City and traffic. First of all, what is Salt Lake City trying to do with their traffic? We'll get into some members of the Utah legislature disagreeing with what they're doing. What are they trying to do?
So Salt Lake City officials have long looked to make the city's famously wide streets friendlier to pedestrians, bicyclists, basically anybody who's not in a car, because these wide streets are fast, they carry a lot of traffic, and can be really dangerous. And so officials have said and said this week that, look, they're just trying to improve safety for people out and about in Utah's capital. There are also other benefits that they've been looking for when it comes to slowing down or calming traffic. You know, by think of the big project along 900 South here in Salt Lake City, that, you know, narrowed a pretty sizable road just to one lane in each direction and added parking in the middle to the median of the road, and then added a big a two-way off-street bike path on the south side of the road. And so now there's only two lanes on that road, but a lot more parking and a lot easier, another way for people to get around. And so Salt Lake City has looked to do some of those projects, not only to keep pedestrians safe, but to increase the availability of active transportation, increase the availability of bicycling as a way for people to get around here and get out of their cars, you know, obviously, and get some of the health benefits that come with that as well.
So let's turn to, with that background, turn to Senate Bill 242. What would this do?
So Senate Bill 242 dropped this week in the middle, actually, of the Salt Lake City Council's regular Tuesday meeting. And what it does is kind of enumerates and codifies some of what UDOT and the city studied around the city's traffic calming program as a part of a bill from last year. So it repeals that study. It makes it harder for the city to reduce on-street parking. That now is kind of becomes a part of this kind of approval process. It says that the city and UDOT have to agree on a four-tier system of roads based on the amount of traffic they carry, right? So they want to draw a distinction between 800 South, a tier one road, a so-called arterial road, and, you know, a neighborhood road like Market Street, let's say, where the Salt Lake Tribune offices are. They want to prohibit traffic calming measures on those biggest roads. State lawmakers want to prioritize vehicle capacity on those roads. And then if the city did want to, you know, make improvements for the safety of pedestrians on those roads, UDOT would have to approve those changes. That also is true for changes to tier two roads. So think of Main Street or 900 East. Then it also widens the state's veto power. Under last year's bill, the area that UDOT could be looking at was east of I-15 and north of 2100 South. Now the area has been widened all the way to Redwood Road and the city boundary, and then as well as Foothill Drive and 600 North, which were a part of the bill last year. And then the last thing, and one of the things that's caused the most consternation, is that the bill requests that the city mitigate impacts of recent infrastructure projects on 200 South, 400 South, and 300 West. These are new, traffic calming measures, bike lanes that have been put in and are either under construction or finished. But state lawmakers want the city to take a second look at those and, you know, mitigate, again, it's kind of a big word, but it's kind of a vague word, mitigate the negative impacts of those projects on those streets.
Will they have to remove some of these measures that they've already put in?
So we asked, or reporters asked the bill sponsor, Senator Wayne Harper, he's a Republican of Taylorsville, about that. And he said that the intent of the bill was to not force the city to take out those that infrastructure, those bike lanes, those kind of curb extensions. He said nothing in here says they have to take that out. He is more interested in making sure that those projects haven't reduced traffic flow, that emergency vehicles haven't been slowed by them, and that businesses kind of remain accessible to cars on those roads. Mm-hmm. So there's possibly some middle ground here, but they'll have to get it. The city will have to get whatever they propose approved by UDOT. So we'll see. There's a long way to go, but I think it's still possible that some of these things could come out depending on what UDOT approves.
Go ahead.
The bill, of course, is not finalized yet. It hasn't even been in a committee hearing. The bill itself has a long way to go, too, of course.
Are legislators saying why they're, you could say they're micromanaging here. They're supposed to be concentrating on all of Utah, and they're concentrating on traffic in Salt Lake City. Are they talking about why they want, you mentioned a couple of reasons specifically, but overall, the macro, why they're getting involved in Salt Lake City traffic?
So for state lawmakers, Stuart Adams in the same immediate availability on Wednesday, Senate President Stuart Adams, that is, he's a Republican of Layton. He said that the capital city is different, that commuters and tourists come into the capital city. They expect to be able to get around. They expect it to be easy for them to get around. They fear that Salt Lake City's traffic calming program has inhibited that ability or could inhibit that ability. That's the biggest thing. I think, on a smaller level, they've had concerns that it's harder for emergency vehicles to get around, it's harder for businesses to, load goods in and out, that sort of thing. So it's, that's kind of where they're coming from. Of course, this is part of a longer history on many different issues of the legislature disagreeing with its largely blue and Democratic state capital.
Let's get to reaction from the Salt Lake City Council. You're right, council members seem united in their reaction to the bill. I believe that reaction is negative about the bill. What are they saying?
Yeah, they were frustrated on Tuesday when they heard about the bill for the first time. There was a couple main concerns. I think one was, they were just frustrated that that they're just trying to help provide safety to the people they represent, to the citizens of Salt Lake City. Councilmember Chris Wharton, who represents the Capitol Hill and Marmalade neighborhoods, known as District 3, said that, if this was a murder rate, the deaths of people on the city's roads, he said about 19 people either died or had really serious bodily injuries from accidents involving cars and pedestrians last year in the city. He said if that was a murder rate, the legislators would be really wanting us to crack down and take some action. So he drew a parallel there. West Side council member Victoria Petro, she had a West Side sort of specific gripe, which was, state legislators, she argued that state legislators don't have the knowledge, the neighborhood by neighborhood analysis to enact bills like this, and that's better left to local governments. And she specifically pointed out that there were three kids who have been killed in accidents on 500 North, I believe she said. Maybe it was 500 West. Anyway, on a key street in her neighborhood since she moved there in 2013, but that none of those deaths have occurred since the city installed traffic calming measures on that road. So she was frustrated that the bill widened the scope of this study and this UDOT's approval. And so that is a concern for her as well. In the past, just one little quick point, the mayor as well as council members have said that, this is they get a lot of calls about traffic calming. Residents want traffic calming. They get a lot of requests about it. And so obviously they're trying to deliver for their constituents as well.
Jose Devila IV telling us about this. Thank you so much.
No problem. I appreciate it, Tom.
So it's time for Underplayed Stories of the Week. Dylan Eubank had to leave. We'll start with Julie Jagg. What's your underplayed story?
Sorry about that. I wanted to give a shout out to Jason Battacchio and his story on the Utah Valley University, possibly not going to be able to go to the NCAA tournament, basketball tournament this year because their administration refuses to pay an exit fee. They're switching from the sorry. Lost my train of thought from the WAC to another conference, and yeah, and so they may have to skip the tournament because they don't want to pay the $1,000 or the $1 million fee for leaving.
Yeah, interesting story. A lot of upheaval in sports, and that's one that I hadn't really even thought of. Thanks for pointing that one out. SLTrib.com for that one. Jose Davila IV, what's your underplayed story?
I just want to throw the spotlight to Robert Gerke, who is often on this show. He had a couple stories this week about the continuing redistricting fight. A couple big news points. One is that the fight has gone to federal court, which in the past that hasn't happened either in Utah or in other states. And two, that the signature gathering effort for the Proposition 4 repeal is in the final sprint, but perhaps is still languishing.
Yeah, SLTrib for that one as well. I'll just mention another one from Robert Gerke. Glenn Beck, a prominent national commentator and host, has weighed in on the judicial changes. He doesn't like them. He takes Utah Republicans to task. SLTrib.com for that one as well. Well, we've been talking about many stories. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We talked earlier with religion reporter Dylan Eubank. Thanks to him. We've been talking with outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Julie, thank you so much.
Always enjoy being here.
Thank you. And West Side Communities reporter Jose Davila IV has been with us. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Have a good weekend.
You too. And hope you'll be with me next time for Behind the Headlines. Thanks for listening, everybody.